So on page 4, this salt crystal discourse, so it's a metaphor of a salt crystal, and I just think this is an interesting, quirky little, you know, sutra that often doesn't get brought up, but I think it's an interesting explanation of part of one of the working aspects of the workings of karma. So, in whatever way a person makes karma or does action, that's how it's experienced. Let's see. So the second paragraph, there's the case where a trifling evil deed or harmful action done by a certain person takes him to a hell realm. There's the case but where the same trifling deed done by another person is experienced in the here and now and for the most part barely appears for a moment. This trifling evil deed done by what sort of person takes him to hell? That certain person is undeveloped in contemplating body, undeveloped in virtue, in mind, in discernment, restricted, small-hearted, dwelling with suffering. So a small negative action by a person who's already tends towards maybe selfishness or something has a big impact, whereas the one for where it hardly appears is that person is practicing, you know, developing virtue, concentration, discernment, and so on, and it's barely noticed. And then the metaphor for this is, suppose someone were to drop a salt crystal into a small amount of water, where the water becomes salty. Yes, it would, because there's not that much water. And then suppose a person dropped a salt crystal into the river Ganges, would that become salty? And no, it wouldn't. So the idea being that, and I think this is somewhat, isn't necessarily intuitive. I thought I could see someone making the case for the other way around, that, because like what we were talking about, for someone who's practicing really in a focused way, really aware, then a small negative action could have a big impact. They could feel that really painfully. This is kind of saying the reverse can happen. And I think the way it could play out is like someone who, like a criminal who, here's a story. Mm-hmm. a criminal who's doing, you know, who's always getting arrested for the same thing or something like that. And then, you know, they're doing some small thing, but the police are like always on their case and like, oh, there he is breaking the law again. We're already keeping an eye on him, you know. And then so they arrest him. Whereas someone who is always doing good, is like known in the town for always helping the town, they're doing the same thing, like, drinking in public or something, right? And they say, oh, you know, this is against the law. You really shouldn't do that. You know, mayor or whoever you are that that is really good in our town. You know, please don't. But of course, we're not going to arrest you or anything. It's just a small thing.
Corruption.
Yeah. And interestingly, the Buddha gives examples that sound kind of corrupt when he goes on. He talks about like the poor person, kind of like that. The person who people. Look down upon is always getting in trouble more, whereas somebody else doesn't. But I think just the application of this would be just that it's worth generally practicing good. If we generally do good in the world and have generally positive approach to people and try to take care of people and so on, then if we make little mistakes, it's more okay. It's a little bit like the, you know, not crying wolf thing. Maybe it's sort of similar principle to that. You know, if you're always like lying about something, then you know, no one's going to believe you at this time.
So it's also like actions aren't in isolation.
Yeah.
So one kicking somebody is one thing, but when you always kick somebody, things aren't in isolation.
Yeah,
connected in a way that affects
Mm-hmm. And the fruition is going to be a bigger, widespread thing than just one kick. It's going to be like the whole way that everyone relates to us then might be like, oh, that's the kicking person. And yeah, so I think we can almost like a karmic reputation or something like that.
When I used to drive a VW van, I would get in trouble with the law much more frequently and more severely. Mm. I went to jail in Livingston, Montana for running a... I just drove from a dirt road onto the main highway, like, you know, it was daybreak, no cars around except these headlights way off in the distance, which happened to be a cop. And he took me into jail, he actually...
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, like, the full de-lousing and everything.
The hippies!
Because I was a hippie, yeah. And then when I kind of caught on to that thing, and I bought a Volvo, and I can get away with all kinds of...
I think you're a liberal if you go to Montana.
They did not even see me. I was completely invisible. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to add thing to that. You know, before we leave Karma, mm-hmm. this is a question about that. My life has been seriously altered because of, I guess I track this, slander and gossip about me. Is recurring gossip all the time, where people create a version of me and then disseminate it and create a league around that version, and that is who I am among these people. This really reached very intense things, and so I'm aware of that, very intense. Like when I burn a hand, it's more sensitive to heat, so I'm very, very sensitive to that kind of thing. So there's a case where I have to say, okay, do I go about and attack or defend and deal this directly? When I went deeply into it, however, what I have concluded is an appropriate response is not to attack or defend the gossip or the slander, but to realize that gossip and slander were my tools of the trade when I was in the Navy. Mm. And that I get to experience all this from the other side.
Mm-hmm. You call that karmic fruition.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, I'm going to break the cycle by responding to it a different way. However, the other end of that is to state with accuracy saying, this is what I see as the case. Boom, 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 boom. Mm. So I am willing to say, okay, look, I'm not going to attack or defend against the gossip and the slander. I will deal with it as bringing my own karmic things to fruition. That's not, I don't care if it's just or unjust, what happens to me, this is how I'm going to deal with this. But what I'm going to report back is the clarity of what I am seeing in the world as I'm experiencing it in as factual a way as possible. And this way I can navigate around. That's the best I can do to deal with karma on a very practical level. I don't know. Is that consonant in any way with his teaching?
Well, just that for you to receive it, because receive whatever's happening is the practice, and you can make it a connection to that you slandered people in the past, or even if not in this life, even if then we say, well, this is coming from something, but the basic practice would be just accept what's happening. That's always the practice of freedom, and then how to respond to other people. Is yeah, not to create more karma when harmful karmic effects come to us and we are suffering, to try not to create more by defending or attacking back or anything.
And in narrating what is real for me, not adding in spin. Say this, the best I could say, this is the factual thing without a spin that I'm providing to it. This is it.
I think that's helpful.
Because every time I want to put a spin on it, I am engaging in what I consider to be harmful speech,
mm-hmm.
wrong speech.
Yeah.
So I lay out the facts as I see them and remain open to a critique, like, you didn't see the whole thing. Okay, fine.
Great. So here's a story from the Buddha's life about receiving karmic effects. People might have heard this story about Angulimala, the mass murderer in Buddha's time, who...
His fingers around the neck
because he, like, he had to
kill
100 people and he had, like, 99 fingers and the last one was going to be the Buddha. Let's get the Buddha. And here he comes down the road and all these people telling Buddha, don't go down that road. Angulimala's there. And, Buddha's like, no problem. And, you know, then he meets him and you can read the whole story. It's the Buddha basically converts him. He's about to murder the Buddha, and the Buddha basically by not attacking back and not defending himself at all, but just stopping completely in this almost miraculous way, then Angulimala says, stop! He's trying to catch up to the Buddha, and the Buddha doesn't seem to be moving, but he can't catch up to him. And the Buddha says, I have stopped, now you stop. Almost a symbolic kind of language. Yeah. And so then he does stop, and he decides never again to kill anyone. And in fact, he becomes a monk under the Buddha. He has all the precepts that keep him totally doing just good. And he has this totally purified life. He's completely changed. His whole mind stream has changed, it looks like. And he's this just great practitioner, really kind to everybody. But then they go out an alms round, and everyone's throwing rocks at Angulimala, because he's like, that's the guy who was the murderer. We don't care if he's a monk. He's like, killed our family. So he always comes back from alms round all, like, you know, beat up by the rocks and people, and he goes to the Buddha and tells him, like, in some pain, I think, like, this is what's happening to me, and, like, what should I do? And the Buddha just says, bear it, Brahman, bear it. Which is like, these are the karmic effects coming to you from what you've done, and there's no way to avoid them, but the practice is just to bear these results. And I think Angulimala, in that extreme case of his story, understood that. He's like, there's no argument there, like, yeah, this is coming to me, I can see why people are throwing rocks. And even though I'm a different person now, and I think in the story, he doesn't try to go to the people, wait, I'm a monk now, and I'm trying to be good, and I love you. Right. He doesn't even, he just takes the rocks.
Right.
And that's the part about not spinning the story. Like, it's not fair.
Yeah.
I think that's another thing about karma that's woven into the whole Indian culture of karma, is my sense of just traveling in India, too, is people don't seem to complain much. People who seem to really be... not well off, like, you know, lepers missing their hands and feet and stuff, will just be smiling. And it could be somewhat my projection. I don't know their deep inner life, but I think it's different than some of the down and out people on the streets of America that look like, are sometimes angry and just like, yeah, good. There's a different kind of response. In general, I felt like the Indian street people, who were much worse off than the American ones, relatively speaking, I think, the spirit seemed to be more like healthy, and like it seemed to be more of an acceptance, I felt. And my story about that is that this teaching of karma in Hinduism and Buddhism and for thousands and thousands of years permeates the culture so much that there is this acceptance. It's just like, this is what's happening. They might not think, because I did something in some other life, but like, we don't say it's not fair. In terms of karma, maybe we could even say, in terms of the teaching of karma, we're never really justified in saying something's not fair. Mm-hmm. Ever, really.
There's a story, the one about Hakuan, where Hakuan lives in this village, and this young girl gets pregnant,
mm-hmm.
and she by this other kid, and she goes to her mother and says, Hakuan the priest did this, Hakuan the priest did this, and everybody in the village believes it, and he's slandered and vilified, and the parents confront him, and they say, you did this, and you're a vile priest, and he says, Asodeska. He says, is that so? He takes the baby and takes care of the baby and for years, and then the girl comes back and says, this other kid did it, it wasn't Hakuan, and then the the parents go back, we're so, so sorry. We're so, so sorry. Please forgive us. And Hakuin says,
and you're so great for taking care of the baby this time.
Yeah, we want the baby back.
Yeah. Just completely accept. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what moved me was your discussion about the seeds of anger and all there.
Mm-hmm.
What I came to understand that resonates with that is that, and the current discussion is that, if I get into the point of blaming somebody for hurting my feelings, I lose the opportunity for rightening. That there may be some provocation, there may be somebody bumping into a bruise, but if I have an extraordinarily excessive reaction to something, I might thank them for doing that. Because I can look into myself and say, this has been something that's been there for a long, long time, and I need to ventilate it, maybe through poetry or something. But you didn't hurt my feelings.
Hmm.
Don't apologize to me for hurting my feelings. May I thank you for releasing them, helping me to release them. It's a very different point of view.
Hmm.
But I could walk around, I did for a long time in my life. You know, I resent that person, I hate that person, I hurt my feelings, did this. And what the teaching is saying is, not really. Maybe it's really a blessing. Maybe it's really a gift.
There's a koan in the Book of Serenity, I can't remember which one, that deals with this principle. And unlike most koans that are dialogue stories between a teacher and a student, it's just a direct quote from the Diamond Sutra. That's the whole koan, and it's called, the title is The Diamond Sutra's Revilement. And it's this section about people being reviled in this life, or being, you know, disparaged or whatever, is something like paying off karmic debts from past lives, and we accepting that. And I can't remember how they work with it and why they treat it as a koan exactly, but that's something around this topic that you could look at. Yeah.
I like the Tibetan notion of purifying negative karma. You know, when I feel like I'm being stoned, beaten, whatever, and I've changed my ways, but I'm experiencing stuff that in some way, and not try and figure it out, you know, do I have a flat tire in Bakersfield and it's 120 degrees out, you know, just, okay, this is a hot hell, or whatever, and I'm purifying negative karma.
Yeah. Yeah, that I think it is often talked about, purifying negative karma. And yet, it's almost like, I think even that way is a little bit of a metaphorical way. It tends to, I think of Andy Ferguson's talk yesterday about, as soon as metaphysics starts getting into a discussion in Zen, we should beware, because this is all really straightforward. And especially when we get into rebirth, this is going to get tricky, because it starts to sound like there's these magical kind of principles involved. And I think we should try, if we take up this rebirth thing, to try to understand it in a very straightforward, practical way that doesn't involve like special magical things. And even to say like purifying karma can have that sense, I think, of like, yeah, like we have this karmic, we're holding this karmic pattern, and by like having bad things happen, we're purifying our like storehouse of karma.
But people distancing yourself from the experience and saying, oh, this is good for me, I'm purifying karma, when in fact you're sweating and you have to find a mechanic and you have to, you know, it seems to me that it's kind of avoiding the situation to put that label on it.
Well, I think what I'm getting at is my motivation. I can see that my motivation, just listening to how this talk has sort of unfolded, that my motivation has changed over time. That initially I felt like a victim of my childhood for, you know, for a time. And that I did not want to come back. I didn't want to be rebirthed. I believe in rebirth. And I am determined not to, if it exists, I'm not taking any chances, because I don't want to go through that whole realm again. So that was my motivation. And over time it has shifted. And maybe, you know, at this point in my whatever, that helps me to get out of that my motivation is more not incurring new unsecure, and new karma, new negative karma, or purifying negative karma, but somehow switching from feeling like a victim to being, you know, I'm at cause. Is the way I see that.
And that could
own this experience.
And if we do come back, let's have it be the best one possible by what we do right now.
And I can see that ultimately, you know, with like the three gates that Andy was talking about yesterday, that the third gate is this non-action, and I think there was something about that in here, that ultimately it's that's where I get to, where I'm just in this sort of flow, you know, I'm just fully present. And I'm not in Bakersfield, you know, in this sort of cause and effect continuum, but I've sort of gotten to this place where all those, you know, in this top of page 2, he talks about all the seeds have been completely turned to ash, washed away. I mean, he talked, you know, it's wonderful.
High
wind and a swift stream, and they're completely gone. All those negative.
By, and the process of doing that is not trying to get rid of anything, which will never work, is more karma, but this complete acceptance. And, you know, it's so easy when we're in a stressful situation to add extra to it and like, say, like, this is so, this shouldn't be happening, or it's, like, not fair, or it's, this is so, I wish this wasn't happening, and that's the karma. I mean, there's other karma of we're actually doing the thing in the situation, like changing the tire is karmic activity too, but it's kind of neutral. Or we could even turn it to good, but then the mental thing of like, this is, you know, this shouldn't be happening, and like, I wish it was cooler and all that, is which is natural that those we do have those experiences. But if we're really aware to catch ourselves, and just studying this, yesterday things were coming up. There was like, even just preparing for this and trying to make this handout, and the printer was running out of ink and stuff, and it was getting really late at night. And I was like, oh man, but I was totally watching this karma thing. I'm like, here it is right now. Like I'm resisting, I'm like creating extra karma by resisting the situation, and which is an inevitable cause and effect situation. Like, I'm determined that we're going to have a handout. And it's like, we're just going to do this. We're going to put the ink in the printer, and we're going to... And then, of course, it's the same situation that's going to happen anyway, but the resistance is so painful in the present, and it's creating this pattern for future resistance in a stressful situation. Of like, well, let's try a different way here. And I feel blessed by the fact that I've just been, like, studying this whole... you know, in words of this karmic stuff, and here it is right now. Let's practice with it. So, moving on to rebirth.
Okay.
The last sutra on page 4, you know, all these sutras you can read at home if you want, but they do talk about birth and other realms throughout, but this one I think is particularly nice section to get into the topic of what is this rebirth. So, this monk Sati says, as I understand the Dharma taught by the Blessed One, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth, not another. So the fifth skanda, consciousness, is what we might think of as that's what's reborn. You know, the body drops away, but consciousness is running through all these rebirths. And the Buddha says, what is that consciousness? And Sati says, it's that which speaks and feels and experiences here and now the results of good and bad actions. That consciousness that's actually also holding all the results of karma, which is something pretty similar to how it's often talked about in Buddhism. That one, that experiencer, is going to get reborn. And so the new birth will be experiencing the result of a past consciousness and past karma. So the Buddha says, misguided man, to whom have you ever known me to teach the Dharma in that way? In many discourses have I not stated consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition there's no origination of consciousness. But, and then he just really starts insulting him, maybe to see if he'll, maybe because of the karma of stating this false view, he's getting reviled by the Buddha now.
He's burning his seeds. He's torching him.
Yeah. You've misrepresented us by your wrong grasp and injured yourself and stored up much demerit from this false view. This will lead to your harm and suffering. The view wasn't that bad, it seems to me. But this is one of the few places where the Buddha talks about, well, this thing of what is reborn. Even though the Buddha talks about rebirth a lot, he doesn't, in the early sutras, it's not explained. Commentaries get really into it, but in the sutras, Buddha says it's not this consciousness, and I think what he's referring to is consciousness is dependently arisen. It's not an independent self. We can make consciousness into, well, who I really am is this core consciousness that's this permanent, unchanging essence of consciousness. And that's like an Atman. That's what the pre-Buddhist teachers would call the self, is something like this refined, subtle consciousness that's the same as when we were born, and that's the one that's going to be reborn again and again, is this stream of subtle consciousness.
But it's interesting. I mean, I know that was passed on from early Buddhist teaching, but then at the same time, you know, Buddhism would say that all things lack inherent enduring self.
Yeah.
So what's this extra thing that's traveling from one body to the next?
Well, he's saying it's not that way in this early sutra, right? He's saying, Sati's saying, I understand there's, and I'm kind of interpolating, saying, mm-hmm. I think Sati's saying consciousness is, basically he's saying that we know there's no self. We know the Buddha teaches there's no Atman, but he's saying, but there is this Vijnana, right, this consciousness, fifth skanda, and he's kind of making it into another version of a self. That's how I understand what's going on. I see there's no self, but there's this consciousness, continuous stream, never-changing, permanent consciousness that's who we really are, and that goes through life to life. That's not a self, right? And then the Buddha says, you're totally wrong. That's not what I teach. I don't say, because have I not stated that consciousness is dependently arisen? It's not a permanent stream, a permanent thing that just continues through life to life. Consciousness is dependently arisen means it arises every moment dependent on conditions. It's not a permanent thing at all. It arises and then it ceases every moment, what we call consciousness, which is kind of a weird idea, but that's how it fits into this system. Everything is impermanent. All five skandhas are impermanent. There's no independent self. We could call a stream, in kind of quotation marks, stream of consciousness. It's just a stream of arising and ceasing moments. But there's no permanent thing. I think that's what is being referred to here. And then the Buddha goes into the 12-fold chain of causation, which is the way of, if we get to this, this is a way of describing how rebirth works, is this 12-fold chain of dependent co-arising. And then I just added in this thing because it's one of these few places where the Buddha does talk about this sort of mechanics a little bit of when there's the union of mother and father, and it's the mother's season, meaning like she's fertile, and the being to be born, there's this term Gandhava or Gandharva in Sanskrit, this being after death who's disembodied being, maybe being driven to a new birth, when all those things are present through the union of those three things. What's that?
Being driven by karma.
Yeah, it's just
yeah, consciousness.
Yeah, and it's just an arising, ceasing thing. Even to call it a being is a little funny, but this is where, you know, it starts sounding like there's some metaphysical thing, which there isn't. But when these things are present, part of it is that there's this moment of consciousness or past karma that's waiting to be born, something like this. And then there's the conception of an embryo in a womb. So it's one of the few places, it seems like, where the Buddha actually talks about there's some previous moment coming in, but it's not the only thing. You need this moment of a sperm and egg joining, and you need you know, all these other conditions, physical conditions, science, that science would explain. So that's a little early thing about rebirth. Now, to get into the, you know, the Tibetans, you know, have this huge description of, they're the ones who really get into the whole rebirth thing and the reincarnated lamas and stuff. Very technical. And some of the Indian teachings, like Abhidharma Kosha, talks about, gets into some of the details, and the Visuddhimagga, so Theravada and Mahayana, all have these classic ancient commentaries that talk about more detailed version of how rebirth works. The Buddha never seemed to get into these, all these weird stories about this, these intermediate beings and so on. But he did talk about birth and rebirth, but he didn't explain, and maybe because he thought it would be a big distraction for us to get into these ideas, and we should just practice, but we should have part of right view, according to the Buddha, is cause and effect and birth over time. And just to throw in one last thing from the early teachings, that actually the description of the Buddha's enlightenment, his night of enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, the main thing that was emphasized is he saw, directly experienced the workings of the Four Noble Truths. He saw the suffering, and he saw the origin of suffering and how it ceases. Very simple insight, but he saw that so deeply that was like the Buddha's total enlightenment. Or some versions, according to the Buddha's own canon, he says he saw dependent co-arising, which is another version really of the Four Noble Truths. He saw how suffering arises and ceases, and saw how that works. And that's what's emphasized in the Buddha's enlightenment. But in the stories in the canon, the Buddha says on these three watches of the night, right? The first watch, he saw all these past lives. His own, I forget which is which of the three watches, but one of the times of the night, he saw this vision of all these like births and deaths, and feelings experienced in all these births and deaths. And he gets even specific. It's not a metaphor, it looks like, because he's saying, I saw I was born to such and such parents, and then disappeared and was born to such and such parents. And so he had this vision of all these past lives. And then the next watch, he saw basically karma. It was like he saw the workings of that all of these lives were created by intentional action and cause and effect, but particularly through karma. And then the third watch was, you know, he saw suffering and the arising of suffering, the Four Noble Truths. And that's the part that gets emphasized. But I find it interesting that in several descriptions in the canon of Buddha's enlightenment night, what he saw was this rebirth thing and karma. The three watches were like rebirth, karma, and then cessation of suffering due to non-grasping. So, and some people say, oh, those were just like shamanic states that he went through, and they weren't really important to his enlightenment. The Four Noble Truths was the key thing. But it's interesting that that's, he talks about them, brings them up in the canon as that's what he saw at that time. And I think a lot of the commentators say they are integral to his vision. The Four Noble Truths may be most important part and easiest to understand how that applies to our daily life in a moment-to-moment way. But the larger vision does include this infinite time, space, cause and effect vision. So I also want to say that in Garfield's translation of Nagarjuna, I thought this was just a really beautiful, his comment on how he understands this karma and rebirth. And excuse me if this sounds too abstract or something, but I think it's a different, you know, he puts it in a way that when I heard this, I felt it as like this moment's experience. And it sounds a little abstract, but the reason I pulled this one out is because I think it's the least abstract way of talking about this, you know, what's being reborn, how does karma get stored, and these kind of weird ideas. This is like, see if this works for you to hear this. He says, the mechanism by which karma operates in rebirth is not that each individual action is a continuum designated That is not that each individual action in the continuum designated as an individual person remains permanently in place or leaves some substantial trace that lies dormant until it produces its consequence. This is often how it's talked about, is that there's these karmic traces or results that are stored in our five skandhas, in the fourth skandha or something like this, and they lie dormant until they come to fruition. And then we talk about alaya vijnana, the storehouse consciousness that stores all of this. He's saying these, we don't have to look at it this way. This is indeed how karma is often conceived by substantialist Buddhist schools. Rather, he's proposing, Nagarjuna talks about like this, and he says, each moment of such a continuum, including the moment of rebirth, is a consequence, through the mechanism of dependent arising, of all the previous moments of that continuum, and of course, much else besides. So, each moment, of, like right now, is a moment of the birth of this person, right now, is the result of all, not just one like stream of like cause and effect action that happened, but like everything independent co-arising of our all our past from beginning this time, all is arriving in this moment right now. And you might say, well, that sounds pretty far out, but actually I see this as more like it's actually kind of a simple thing. It's just that everything's led up to right now. It's kind of common sense in a way. Everything that's ever happened to us has led up to this moment with all the complexity of our mental state and physical state at this moment is the result of all past physical and mental actions and much else, meaning like the weather and the temperature in the room and everything else, right? That's just dependent co-arising. Again, like each thing abiding in its dharma position right now is the result of all of dependent co-arising. But particularly we're looking at all the past karma of what we call me. Each moment of such a continuum that we call this person is a consequence through the mechanism of dependent arising of all the previous moments of that continuum and everything else, much else also. Those karmic consequences are, as it were, summed up in the total state of the individual at birth. Every moment of our lives represents the causal consequences of all our prior actions. At each moment, we are the total consequence of what we have done and what we have experienced. I just thought this was a kind of unusual way of talking about it, but it's in a way very simple, I think. Especially that last sentence. Each moment, we are just the total consequence of everything we've ever done and experienced. And you could say, at birth of a new being, which and rebirth is nice because it's the same principle as every moment of this life, where the five skandhas are ceasing, and dependent on that cessation, there's the arising of new five skandhas, or say body and mind. Our body-mind experience ceases every moment impermanently, and new one arises dependent on the previous one. And since it's dependent on the previous one in this particular way, that it looks very similar to 1 second ago. We all feel pretty much like we did a second ago, but actually it's a new birth. And then this process of arising and ceasing, and each birth being the complete consequence of everything we've ever done and experienced every moment, which is a kind of radical vision, but I think we can open to how that could be. This is how it is right now. That's why we're all individual, unique people. And this continues, this process continues all through our life. We're evolving, the body is changing, the mind is changing, all five skandhas. And then we approach the end of what we call this life. And there's this particular dramatic moment in this continuum of dependent co-arising where particularly physically, the form skandha, we could say, the body and its conditions, the four elements of the body, you know, the physical body, actually its conditions for life support in a particular moment end, right? The breath stops and the heart stops. And so that And then that continues to have the physical, we don't maybe call it the form skanda after the breath stops, because it's not a skanda of a person. It's now it's this physical thing that starts to decay and has its own physical, dependently arising thing that goes into the ground or gets burned or whatever. The physicality goes on. It's not that the body doesn't disappear. I mean, it continues to arise and cease and evolve into dust or something. We could say the law of conservation of energy is like this: physical things don't disappear. But then the other skandhas, we could just call mind, at that last moment, so there's consciousness is arising and ceasing, and then so a moment of consciousness arises, and then it ceases, and consciousness or mind is dependent on the body, so now the body's no longer working, the heart stops. So the body is not there to support the next moment of consciousness. So then but there has to be, in the stream, there's always a resultant, you know, the cessation of a moment of consciousness is a condition for a new moment. So the way it would be talked about traditionally is that the moment of cessation is a condition for a new moment, but we need a new body now. Because mind and body can't be separated, which is what a big thing is that Stephen Batchelor says. It looks like there's this mind-body split in this Tibetan way of talking about rebirth. But I think we can talk about rebirth where there's not a mind-body split, and there's not also mind and body are not the same, just like in that sutra. Are they the same or are they different? Those are two extreme views. We could say mind and body are dependent. That mind and body depend on each other. Doesn't this seem to be common sense too? That actually we can't, the mind we call mind of like awareness depends on the body, particularly the brain. We could say the brain is different than the mind. The brain's a physical organ, but the mind, which is like clear awareness, depends on this, now we know, the brain and the rest of the body. And maybe this would be a more Buddhist view, is that the body actually depends on the mind. A kind of materialist view would be like, no, there's the body first, and then the mind is produced by the brain. But we would say the mind and body depend on each other. And in Buddha Dharma, it's like mind is foremost. We say mind is the physical and verbal karma come from mind, mental karma. So mind is what we work with in Buddhism, but mind is connected to body, or connected to, or to be more accurate, let's say dependent on. They're interdependent. And so they talk about these intermediate beings and so on, but one way of talking about rebirth, and maybe the most simple way, would be this interdependent body and mind that's both arising and ceasing, dependent on other conditions too, and physical conditions outside. Very dynamic. Again, I think we could go crazy trying to get a hold of what that's like. Very dynamic, arising and ceasing, impermanent life, though. It's life. And that's going along. And then now we're talking about these two different aspects of mind and body. They're two different aspects in order to talk about them, but they're completely interdependent. So the body, what we call the body, ceases, the heart ceases, and so on. But the mind has its own stream. You could say each of them, mind and body, has its own. Like this body depends on the last body moment, so the body looks pretty much the same, and it's slowly decaying. But we can't really perceive that happening, this arising and ceasing. And the mind has its own stream; it's arising and ceasing. And they're completely, we don't want to separate them, so it's hard to talk about it without starting to think about them as different, but they're completely interdependent. But at this last moment, it's important that there's two different streams of evolution, we could say, that the body ceases, and then the body continues its own dead corpse stream, right? And the mind, mind moment ceases, and then the next one arising needs a new body. So one way, without getting into these weird ideas about these intermediate bardo beings, is that right at the moment of the one body dying, along with this mind, now the body's takes its own track, and that mind, the next moment of mind, and a moment is like smaller than a second, right? That next moment, that mind moment connects with a new body, we could say, which would be like a meeting of a sperm and an egg. That mind moment, the next mind moment is now switches bodies. And that's where it gets kind of weird. Like, which body? Which, like, sperm and egg? Was this person over here? How does that happen? And, like, I don't even think we want to get into it because we have no idea.
But isn't that the same thing that Sati was saying? The consciousness?
Yeah. So he was talking about there's this... Yeah, it sounds very similar. And this is a key thing. So Sati says it's the same consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth. So if we look, I think he's saying there's this continuous stream that's reborn, as opposed to there's this arising, cessation. And what we mean by that is like that consciousness is completely gone. So the consciousness we had 1 second ago, according to this system, is like, it's gone. It's like it will never relive the same mind moment. But when it ceases, that cessation is a condition for a new arising a second later. And the classic metaphor for this is like a movie projector, an old style movie where there's little frames, right? And it's like each frame actually is a separate frame. And but when you string them all together fast and put light through it, it looks like a moving image. Right, we see it as a movie, but it's not.
Is it the same consciousness?
Sati thinks it's the same stream, like a movie. Looks like it's the same movie, but when you stop the movie, you see there's these individual frames. It's not the same picture. It's different frames.
So is it the same?
It's on the same film strip, though.
Same film strip. I mean, it's a metaphor, so yeah, it starts to break down. But I think the point, and this is, you could say, well, this is getting a little too technical, but this is this very key, subtle point that makes to me, it makes the only thing that can make it make sense, rebirth, is that there's not this continuous consciousness, but there's a cessation of a moment of consciousness. Does this make sense? That we have a moment, this is kind of like we're imagining this realm where there's one moment of consciousness, and in this very dynamic way, it's dependent on the body too, but we're just looking at the consciousness for now. I say that moment of consciousness, split second, actually, because everything is completely impermanent, means like not gradually changing, but means like everything only lasts one tiny, tiny moment. It ceases, and then, but a cessation, this is part of the maybe weird thing too, every moment of cessation is a condition for something else to happen. Because that's cessation is actually something happening, so it's not just like the cessation of a moment and then nothing else.
So it's
according to dependent co-arising.
As though you would be saying that it's not that there's one continuous stream, but in each second there is thousands of rebirths, and it looks like a continuous stream, or
exactly,
or there's a new dharma position that feels like a self that is
exactly
along the film, and but it's not actually like that,
and it feels like it is. So this is an example where this dharma of basically depend, this is all just a way of talking about dependent co-arising too, which is one of the Buddha's main teachings. It doesn't feel, it's like it, we don't experience things according to the Buddha's teaching. So that's why it gets, if we're saying, well, everything, we should just be directly experiencing everything and we shouldn't even need all these words. This is an example where we actually need these teachings that don't seem to accord with our experience. And then we meditate on them again and again. We keep contemplating them and trying to, you know, refute them or see how they don't seem to make sense. And again, seeing how this is, I can see how this could make sense. But even though it's abstract, and then eventually it becomes our experience. But it starts with an abstract conceptual idea. But if first there's Dharma teachings in words and paper and so on. And by like meditating on it in a conceptual way, this is kind of diverging into the basic path of how we use Dharma teachings. We take them in more and more to our experience, and then eventually we start experiencing dependent co-arising, not as an abstract idea, but like actual experience. Yeah.
I think all of this esoteric stuff came from Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism especially, because country music hasn't come yet. Because there's a song in this. And I think the title of the song should be, "I'm Gonna Miss Me When I'm Gone." And I think that's the root of all this. I'm gonna miss me when I'm gone.
I wonder if the difference between, you know, or it's probably this, I'm getting glimmers of it being the same, but that maybe the Tibetans, my experience of the Tibetan thing was there was this taking bodhisattva vows, which is, you know, I am coming back through until every being becomes enlightened. So, and to help me along, to help me complete that commitment, I understand the death experience to be like this, and in this, you know, as the senses, you know, I see sparks and smoke, and the light becomes dim, and things sort of waver like a mirage, and
this is the Tibetan description.
Yeah, and I have this last breath, and there's this seed, this essential seed, and I project this essential seed out, and I have like 45 days to find the next body to, in, you know, with a healthy family, basically, mm-hmm. you know, in conditions that will help me to experience the Dharma,
mm-hmm.
to make the most of mm-hmm. another life.
Start out where I left off.
Yeah.
Good head start.
Rather than just kind of going through unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
And the what I see as maybe different is that in Zen, there's this gate of non-action, that I get to mm-hmm. this point where I'm no longer creating cause and effect. I'm no longer creating negative karma or positive karma. I'm just sort of experiencing what is, and at the moment of my death, I stop this cycle of rebirth.
Mm-hmm. Although Zen would say we also have these bodhisattva vows.
Right, that's so, where I think it's...
Well,
there
but,
is something.
But the way you could combine those two is to say, actually, it's not this kind of magical thing like that you're searching for a good womb and so on. But it's more like it's just simple intention in this life that's directed in wholesome ways, and that's going to, if there is a rebirth into another life, that it's going to be based on just like the whole sum of karma from this life. And some people say, well, the last moment before death is that the karmic shape of that moment is the one that's going to determine the quality of rebirth. But even then, even if we have that view, it's still say that last moment of death is going to be completely conditioned by everything from this life and all previous life. And it's going to be most people die in a very not clear and confused, murky, and very frightening situation. So we're not going to, I think the idea is we're not going to have so much control at the last, literally last moment of consciousness before death. So, but if we practice really fully in this life, so that our basic karma, even when we go, even when things get, we get senile even or something, the karma extreme is still going to be positive. And I've seen this in, there was this guy I met at Tassajara once who, to get into a story, to get out of the abstraction, is this guy who was an older guy who was, I think, senile, and he'd been practicing Zen in another Zen center for decades, you know, and he was like, as some people like this are, he was like, didn't really make sense, you know, and he was there as a guest, and he he met me somehow, and he just kept connecting with me. He kept calling me a different name, like, "Oh, you're like Johnny or something," and I said, "No, I'm not." And, "Oh, yeah," and he would just—he didn't care that I said I wasn't him. He just kept relating. "So, tell me about how it was," and so, you know, it was pretty weird. But like, I started hanging out with him more, and I could, you know, play that other person, and his story would change about me. But it was very, he was totally not in the usual world, and luckily he had this wife there who was together, who would kind of take care of him, because he couldn't really, I think he could function and he could feed himself and stuff like that, but his story about reality was totally askew. And I think it was like when people start to lose their memory, but his energy was like totally positive. He was like joyful all the time. He would just sit in the pool and float around. It's like, it's amazing, isn't it? It's like such a beautiful day. And he never had any, he was totally confused. But I think most people, or maybe a lot of people, when they get to this realm, it's terrifying to be that confused, or else really disturbing. And like, I'm sorry, who are you? And I can't remember. And like, and I think we can see this with people near the end of their life, that their life really is the sum of their whole previous life. So this guy, my story anyway, was that he'd been practicing just acceptance and giving and positive energy through his life. So when he started to lose it, it was still like this, he was content, actually. And so if there was if he died in such a realm, even if it was very confused, it would be this, what we would call like positive karma of non-greed, hate, and delusion, or maybe delusion. at least non-greed and hate, and just like accepting what is kind of the non-delusion part, and that would produce a good effect. So this is the case for these, I think it's sort of a funny story that the Dalai Lama makes this big point about like, we should practice in such a way that our last moment of life, because that one moment is going to determine the whole thing. And it's kind of saying that even if we have a really good life, and but at the last moment somebody like, you know, insults us or something, and right before we die we like have resentment, it's like that's going to determine the whole thing. So it's like, he said we should have people be very calm around us when we're dying because of this.
From my experience, it bypasses the physiology of where you have a stroke or where you have damage. Mm. You know, in terms of dementia, there are some happy demented people who have dementia. But I guess my view is that it's related to the functioning of the brain
yeah,
rather than the functioning of the patterns.
So yeah.
Some patterning, you know.
Yeah.
You may be a great runner, but if you don't have legs, then you're not going to run.
Yeah. So I think there are, and this gets into...
So I guess I fall on the side of the scientific...
Yeah, well here we have Stephen Batchelor.
There we go.
And,
my hero.
And first, this is the view that he talks about. So there's this Tibetan teaching from this guy, teacher Dharmakirti, who this is what is called the proof for rebirth in the Tibetan system. And... you know, whether it holds up or not, it did have some impact when I read it. I thought, it's pretty good. They're really making a good try at this. And the idea, to try to put it briefly, is it's from the point of view of the newborn child. And so it's like, it's saying this, basically, to try to simplify it, it's like, the newborn child has life faculty, which, you know, they talk about, it breathes, and it has sense powers, for example. It's like the life faculty. And it has mind, which shows anxiety, even as an infant child. It has mind with these like karmic patterns from birth, basically. And the basic argument is that in dependent co-arising, that things arise from similar things. So just like this dependently arising body-mind experience right now arose, I didn't just like pop out of you or something. I popped out of this very similar, again, it's like we call a stream. A stream is really just arising and ceasing, but it's very similar to the previous me. what I call me, right? Previous body and mind experience. So life, what we call the life faculty, must arise from something similar. It doesn't arise from like a rock. Life faculty, like breathing being, doesn't arise from a rock. It has to arise from something like an other life faculty, is the proposal here anyway. And so you could say, well, life faculty, people would argue, well, it comes from the parents' life faculty. And that's what, maybe a scientist would say it like that, that the moment of a new birth is the life of that child actually is the life faculty of the parents. So we can go with that. But then there's this other thing called mind. And this is where the argument comes in, I think. It's where it gets interesting. Because mind, according to Dharmakirti, can't arise from something dissimilar, like a brain, for example. He's saying mind is defined as clear awareness, is what we call mind. And not so much like, you know, maybe feelings and other more grosser aspects, but the most subtle, clear awareness. And I like to think of like in deep zazen, when it just seems like you have this awareness and it seems like this is amazing miracle that there's such awareness. This can't just be like synapses in the brain producing this vast awareness of spaciousness. I mean, maybe scientists would say, yeah, that's just synapses in the brain producing this virtual reality, vast awareness. I think it's easier to say if like a feeling is produced by chemicals in the brain. It's a mental experience. So I think that's where it starts to get blurry. But just, I think that Dharmakirti is coming from a kind of a meditation experience position of like when we're really in that spacious, open awareness realm, our sense, and maybe this is our deluded sense, I'm up for looking at it that way too, but at least for me, it feels, my sense is that like this is not just like chemicals in the brain here, right? This is like a miracle that we can't say what it is, but like it's too vast. It's too vast to be produced by chemicals in the brain. That's why I think it's good to come to the, you know, spacious awareness kind of aspect of mind. Now it could be, right? But my like intuitive sense is like it's something vaster than chemicals in the brain. And that's where it kind of comes down, I think. So this proof would be that vast, spacious awareness arises from something similar. It doesn't arise from a body, or we might say a brain, a physical brain. It has to arise from something similar, which would be another moment of consciousness or awareness. And in that and then an argument might come in. It's the parents' consciousness that merge together and produce a third consciousness. And in the Buddhist system, they say this cannot happen, that consciousness can never split itself into multiple people, right? Like our consciousness right now, we can't like emanate like another conscious body over here or project our consciousness, split our consciousness into like me and another body. Now there are weird stories in Tibetan about this, but this thing would refute this, and it's not common sense. Consciousness can't split. So therefore, the body and cells can split in science. So you can have the parents producing a third being physically. That, I think, works. But to say that this vast awareness that the parents have to, almost you could call like Buddha nature or something, that they have individually, the parents, that they could somehow produce that spacious awareness, Buddha nature, in a third being, they're saying that we can't. That sounds metaphysical, actually. That sounds like a weird magic thing. And I think they would say, well, it sounds even more magic or equally magic to say that it comes from another moment, from another life. But just offhand, I would say, to me, it sounds a little less magic to say that one particular stream that's not splitting into different ones ceases, and then that stream of cause and effect, consciousness cause and effect, can then be, manifest the next moment in a new life. because nothing has to split that way. There's individual streams. It doesn't get messy, and each individual stream has its own stream of cause and effect. And it's not like the parents. It gives too much like credit to the parents that they could like make a mind. They could make a Buddha nature from their own natures, or they could join their own Buddha natures. It's like, to me, that seems funny. So. That's the basic like argument, is that body comes from body and mind comes from mind, and that's where then we get.
Split of body, mind.
But so the non-split part is the very important part that I mentioned earlier, that they're not separate. Body and mind are completely interdependent. They're not the same, and they're not separate. Those are two extreme views, that they're the same or separate. They're completely interdependent, but we can talk about them separately, and so. You have these completely so this is the vision, kind of abstract vision, right? That there's a body and mind completely interdependent. And they're moving along, arising and ceasing. And then at the moment of death, boom, this body starts doing its own set of cause and effect. And in a way you could say, at that moment, that body and mind are no longer dependent on each other. There's a moment where the dependence splits, but you can't have the split. You can't have a mind without a body. So immediately, this is the story I like, is that there's no intermediate disembodied mind floating through space looking for a womb. That the more easy one is like, it immediately, that mind, the next moment of mind must depend on a body. Right? So it can't just cease with nothing after it. There has to be a new moment of arising. So we need a body. This body doesn't function anymore. It's dead. So boom, we have an embryo. And now mind is still this mind and body are completely dependent or connected, and so you could say at that one moment where and it's literally would be like a moment where one body ceases and another body arises. There's no gap. There's no disembodied mind, and mind and body are not the same. They're not identical, but they're completely interdependent, and you just have this leap of. You know, of dependence on one body to dependence on another body. And if you don't have that story, then, and we don't, all these are just stories, right? We can't prove any of it definitively. But is there another story that's better, that works more clearly? And when I think of the other stories, they get even weirder. Even to say that it ends and there's nothing at all after.
But there's another part, and we probably don't have time to get into it, which is how does believing a certain story affect how you behave?
Yes.
Because the story is sort of an interesting story. I don't buy it, but it's sort of an interesting story. But does that affect me? If I believe it, then how does that affect me?
Yes.
You know, and I'm more aware of that in the Christian stories than I am in the Buddhist stories, because the Buddhist stories aren't so deep in me.
Yes.
The Christian stories are.
Well, let's get into that, because that's in a way, I think the whole importance of it is how it affects our life.
Right. And I have to go to the bathroom.
Well, that's the motivation. Like, how does awareness of this threat of a bad rebirth motivate me to think, be today. What I also found comforting about the Tibetan, you know, story about death was that it was a very thorough, it has the potential to be a very thorough anticipation, or, you know, this is what you're likely, it's probably going to look like. This is And I've seen people die, so I know that there's some truth, and it makes sense that the body
gets stages.
Cooler and that I can expect to have these sensations, and I can meditate on what's that like to go through those stages of dissolution, where the body's working.
Although we don't know about the orange light turning into the gray light and things like this,
Well, yes, and it's not that it's not too far fetched. It didn't, when I heard these descriptions, they made some sense. I mean, they're related to the skandhas. They're related to things that are commonly held as helpful in describing the experience of being.
Yeah, and whether it's good or not, that we, it's comforting to know how it's going to be, or whether it's a made-up story to falsely comfort us. And these are some of the effects. I just want to say one about Stephen Batchelor's thing. That's where, and this would be a longer discussion sometime, but when he hears this proof that we just talked about the mind having its dream and the body having its dream, he's disturbed by the fact that it seems like a mind-body split. So I thought that he took it as that extreme of body and mind are separate, and how could they be? It's one whole. And that his understanding of modern brain science and so on is that we can have a mind produced by a brain, and yet I think this view that's not either extreme, if they're split or they're not split, but the middle way of they're completely interdependent, but we can talk about them separately. He didn't get into that, and that's, I would love to have that conversation with Stephen Batchelor.
And the thing that struck me with Stephen Batchelor was the question, can human beings behave kindly or not harming without the threat of an afterlife?
Yes.
Or without a threat of karma? Mm-hmm. And that's what is the rage of commentary between people who are religious and people who are not religious, you know, is... Do humans need this threat in order to be good?
Yeah.
And I tend to think they don't, because I have a story about the threats being more harmful. So.
And you can see that they don't, because in this life we experience the result of harmful actions, right? I think that's true. That karma plays out in this life too, so we know if... It's like, it doesn't matter because we're just going to die and then it's all over. But in this life, if we want a quality life in this life, yeah, we're going to do good.
Well, and how we learn to do good is the question. and kind of the theory that I play with is that if I can see the pain that's created by my behavior, then I want to do good.
Yeah.
I want to not create pain.
Yeah.
And the whole nonviolent communication that Gandhi was doing was, let the person beat you, because when you're not fighting it, they will see the pain that they're creating, and then they will change.
And it worked.
And it doesn't go into rebirth, and it doesn't go into heaven and hell. It doesn't go into... It goes into the idea that humans are basically good, and that they have this covering of delusion. And if you allow the covering to be more clear, then you're more likely to be good. So, I think that's what the issue is around rebirth, is whether we need to have rebirth in order to
do good, to be motivated to do good.
To be moral.
Yeah.
Or is it possible that the morality lives within us?
I would say that we don't need that view to be good, and to just, you know, come... to have a kind of middle way position. I would say we don't need it, because we see how it works in this life. To have a happy life, we're going to be act in a non-harmful way. We're happier that way in this life. And I would say that the rebirth vision, that view, just creates the same idea, the same thing that works in this life. It just makes it that much stronger, or you could say deeper. It could make it that much stronger or deeper, particularly around the realms that the visions of, I vow to become a completely awakened Buddha to like save all beings from suffering, not just like the people around me in this life. And we have in Zen, we have that Bodhisattva vow. It's this vast, like unimaginable vision, and like in that life, in that vow or vision, then I think it could be helpful than to think like, I can't save all beings in this life, but like, I have my vision is so vast, it needs many, many lives to do this work. And it might be the motivation to like, even if I don't finish creating the conditions for these people, that, or for my own realization of bodhisattva or Buddhahood, it's not gone to waste. I mean, we can have that in this life too. It's not gone to waste, but This is a vaster, grander view of like that we can keep doing this where we left off. Either way, I think.
It's really harmful in that.
Oh, how could it be harmful?
In that, that's how castes were created. That's how people are blamed for the. So you have a damaged child. That's your karma. That's the child's karma.
And how is that harmful?
Castes,
I see, but to say that someone was born this way, and that's due to cause and effect. How would it be? What's a more helpful view of why? As long as you're taking care of them.
I think it's so easy to fall into blaming and to guilt and you know.
But the Buddha's
and self-loathing.
But see, the Buddha's teaching doesn't get in. I mean, people misinterpret it. But the Buddha never said you should be guilty or blame, right?
No, it's but I'm saying that, and I'm seeing.
But it could get into that.
Really harmful in me, I guess. Maybe I'm
I think it could be misused. Either way, it could be rebirth view or no rebirth view could be misunderstood and misused and cause a whole bunch of harm. And either view can be used appropriately, according to how the Buddha proposed it. And in fact, that's karma, right? Everything, what we're doing with our karmic, our intentions around everything, are create the world, actually. Intentions are creating the world.
I have the same problem of worrying about the guilt trip. See if I can say this. But what I'm getting right now, listening, and that there are some cultural values, and there are also some, spiritual values, that maybe some of the concepts of rebirth, especially that the Tibetans teach, have some kind of impact on enlightenment, if I can use that word, that are different than the cultural.
I haven't studied enough to know.
That seeing life as a bardo, or seeing these in-between spaces, has some value for the awakening of the mind beyond just the guilt trips. I was going to say there may be a value that is not cultural and controlling, but has to do with awakening mind. I'm thinking out loud.
Sure. No,
question as you about the guilt.
Well, I think for me, and what I've seen with people dying is that what we use in our culture is morphine to kind of take away what. It's said that it's pain, but I personally believe it's more about anxiety than pain. If it was pain, ibuprofen is a pain, blocks pain receptors, and you can do the same thing with that. However, it doesn't do anything for the anxiety. Whereas morphine puts you in a euphoric state. It's, heroin, cocaine, morphine, same sort of whatever. And I think for me, it's sort of like being on the side of the road with a broken car in 120 degree heat, rather than feeling a victim of it, thinking, reframing it and saying, okay, well, this is my death experience, and I'm going to sit with it without the anxiety. There was a Dharma talk Wednesday last, Liz, I don't know her last name, Zoli?
Milazzo.
Milazzo, yeah. So anyway, it was very good, and she spoke about her aunt dying, and very determined, no drugs, no doctor, I'm just going to sit with this emphysema. Scared, the anxiety was pretty apparent, and yet that determination to just sort of be present and go through that death experience was very compelling. I don't think anybody in the room, everybody that heard that story was like, oh, that was the right way to go. It just was like, awesome. And it was a confidence that this woman had that she was doing the right thing, and a determination, commitment. And I think having some sort of a story, a compelling story about what I'm up to. Why am I sitting zazen to attain enlightenment? Why am I not taking morphine in my as my body's, you know, not ceasing to work, and I'm feeling afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I staying with this and staying mm-hmm. conscious and trying to stay in this non-action?
And whether there's rebirth or not, it seems like the laws of karma apply equally. And it's like, and I think in the end, none of us can say we really know, you know, because we're doing the sutras, we're presenting the Buddha's view. But I'm not even saying I'm not going to take a stance one way or the other. But I think in either case, the way we live is going to be pretty much the same. That's where the karma part is so important. Karma is kind of undeniable, the way this works. May we live in such a way that benefits others. I see we're up to 1:15.
I'd like to make one comment if I can. In February of 2002, I meditated myself to death, literally. Didn't require a story. I did that intentionally. And I came back, all right? And I came back with some notions. And those notions carried forward, and they've done a great thing in my life, and they happen to coincide with what we discuss in Zen, in Soto Zen. So it's very comforting to find that. Carrying that forward, a year ago, almost the day, I guess, I spent with a bunch of other people a lot of time with Stephen Batchelor before this was published, and he was talking about this, and he was talking about this very issue. And I spent about 20 minutes afterwards, and I said, Stephen, you are giving rebirth to the thing you're objecting to every time you object. And he goes, I know. Mm. And I said, he goes, well, how would you deal with it? And I said this to him, and this, other people have heard me say this before. I said, God, which is the issue that many people have here, is a three-letter word that stands for everything that I do not know at this moment. Everything that I do know can only arise, anything I will know can only arise out of the I don't know space. And I learned that on my deathbed at number 17 Blue Sky Lodge in Carmel Valley. That one can simply get comfortable with the I don't know and put everything one does know right there and go, both. This is it. At that moment, there is a sense of what's going to arise in the I don't know. That's why I said earlier the country song is I'm gonna miss me when I'm gone. If you break that record, I'm gonna miss me when I'm gone, and say I don't know, and I know, and I don't know, and you stay in that koan space, I think you have what's being talked about in a very simple term that lets me anyway navigate my decision making and how I interact in the world. It doesn't require a superseding narrative to adopt. It is what it is at the moment. And it gets embodied the way Kathy's talking about.
And yeah, and we don't know. And we can talk more after this. But I'd just like to thank everybody for coming and exploring this difficult, challenging topic. And, you know, there was so much more that I was thinking that we could bring up. But as you see, when we get into it, it involves lots of different areas. And so we can keep studying, and there's, you know, you can read these sutras and if you'd like. And just, we also have a thing of dedicating merit, right, which is completely about karma. It's like saying, we've created this karma, and now we like offer it for the best benefit that it can be. So all the karma we've all created this morning, we dedicate to the complete freedom from all karmic effects for all beings. Everywhere.
Thank you for studying so hard and bringing forth this.